As I'm looking through a return, I want to do an analysis. I'm just not trying to get that number on a line. I'm trying to make sure that number makes sense. I want to have a conversation. That's why I like to specialize in real estate, because I can have conversations that create more conversations, that create potential planning. That's how we advise.
You're listening to 5-Hour Real Estate Week, where you'll learn to consistently buy real estate in only 5 hours a week. So if you're ready to invest in real estate, achieve financial freedom, and own the lifestyle you deserve, even with your job, this is the show for you. Now, here's your host, Mike Butler.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the 5-Hour Real Estate Week podcast. And I'm your host, Mike Butler. And we got a very special guest today. And our topic is tax updates for real estate investors. This is part six of a six-part series. My special guest is Eric Shadowins, and we're going to go over in this final episode tax due date. So let's jump right into it.
Thanks, Mike. So we've gone over a lot of information in our prior series, and today hopefully is a good one, helpful to you to understand what needs to be filed. You know, we're in January right now, and you have some due dates coming up that you want to be aware of. You may not even know who's going to be doing the work for you. And what do you need to be doing right now? Not even for last year, but next year. Sometimes tax advisors, they're used to looking at prior year. They're more reactive. Myself, I like to try to be proactive. So I want to be having conversations with my clients about what's going on this coming year, in addition to what happened last year when I'm preparing a tax return. So the first thing I'll just point out, tax due dates. This isn't all inclusive because I may have missed something to point out, but we had talked earlier about 1099s in one of the other series. Keep in mind, 1099s are due this month. Very important to get those out. They're due January 31st. You'll need to file one with the IRS. You'll need to send one to the recipient, that is your contractor. And if you're in an area like us here in Louisville, Kentucky, we have a locality tax. And you would be required to file what is a 1099 SF with Jefferson County, the county that we reside in. So that's for your 1099s. We'll skip the next one and we'll come back in a little bit. But keep in mind partnership and S-Corp returns. We talked about in one of the series, the different entities and the different business returns that are required. So partnership and S-Corp returns are going to be due March 15th. That's for federal purposes. For a lot of states, those states, they won't be due until April 15th, but that's where it gets complicated because some states are due along with the federal return and some are not. But something to keep in mind to talk to your tax advisor about. Also keep in mind there might be a locality return that has to be filed. Here in Jefferson County, we have the Form OL3 that we had to file. We have over, I think, 120-something counties here in Kentucky, and a majority of those require some sort of business return or business license to be filed. So something to keep in mind. Next is the individual returns. Those returns are due April 15th. And then I'm going to jump back to partnerships and S-Corps again. Keep in mind, I said March 15th is the due date for partnership and S-Corp returns. Generally on the federal side, there isn't anything due. You don't have to pay anything. So you can easily extend your federal return March 15th. And then you don't have to worry about it. It extends it until September 15th. But what that does for tax preparation purposes, for your tax advisor, it allows them to at least April 15th, and it gives them a chance to look at your business return along with your individual return together and have it completed by April 15th. So that's something to consider. And when I do it with my clients, I file it. You don't even have to sign anything as a taxpayer, as a client. I can e-file it, it gets accepted, and you don't even know about it. You know, I tell you that I'm doing it, but you don't have to fool with anything on the extension side. Excuse me, on the extension side, if you decide to do that. Okay. Going back to the individual returns, due April 15th, we're going to talk about that in the choosing a tax advisor section, but April 15th gets crazy. Actually, the middle of February, it really starts getting crazy for me. And then when we get into March, we're talking, you know, the 80 and 90 hour work weeks. I can't say that I do 90 hours. I've done a couple in my career. And once I get above 60, I don't know what I'm thinking anyway. So it gets crazy. But point I'm making is if we get to April 15th on all of my clients, if I don't have them done, I will have them to a point that I have all their information in the return or the most that I can get if they haven't given me something. And I'm going to know what kind of shape they're in. that if we do an extension, they're going to know what their liability looks like so that we can make a payment on April 15th. Because when you extend a return, that extends the due date of filing the return. It doesn't extend the due date of paying your liability. So very important on April 15th, if your return's not done, hopefully your advisor has your return in a certain shape that you all can discuss an extension amount along to be paid with the extension that you're doing. So then I can back up to the second topic. I should have had it here at the bottom, quarterly estimates. There are situations, if you are a W-2 taxpayer, when you are paid, you have withholdings done for you. You have your federal, your state, and potentially local withholding. You don't have to necessarily worry about making estimate payments, because in the eyes of the IRS, they require you, the taxpayer, to pay your tax liability evenly throughout the year. So as a W-2 taxpayer, it's mostly all the time that you are paying your tax evenly throughout the year for your W-2 income. But there could be a situation where you're a realtor, or if you're in a, you're a flipper and you're making money, or your real estate, your long-term holds and your short-term rentals are making money, net income. You don't have any withholdings going on with those. So quarterly estimates are important, and you want to pay those. They're due on April 15th, June 15th, September 15th, and January 15th of the following year.
And let me jot this down.
Yeah.
Quarterly estimate payments.
Yep.
And what are those dates?
April, June, September, and January, all 15th.
Okay. April, June. You said August?
September.
September.
And January.
January. Okay. Go ahead.
On the 15th. So when I work with clients and I'm getting to that extension point, I might include an amount for their first quarter estimate for the following year in their extension payment. That's hard to visualize, and that's a conversation just you might hear it from your advisor, but just know sometimes extension payments might include that first quarter estimate. But let's just say I get your return done. It's April 14th and you're done. If you had an amount due, what I will do, I will prepare, and it's not just me, advisors do this, I'll prepare quarterly estimate vouchers, and I'll send that to you along with your tax return. And I'm trying to get you to pay at least 100% of your liability from the prior year if all of that was not withheld. Whatever amount that wasn't withheld in the current tax return I'm preparing, I divide that over four, and I send that in estimate vouchers and filing instructions to my clients so that you know to pay that on those four dates.
Okay.
But what happens if your income significantly changes through the year? So if you're typically, if you're working with an advisor, actually a preparer, that you just drop things off in tax season and you don't see them again until next tax season, there's a disconnect there. There's a miscommunication, or not a miss, but no communication going on where you're working with a tax advisor. What I'm going to tell you is give me a call if your income changes significantly, because maybe the market doesn't change as I, you know, I've been saying, I'm thinking it's going to change in the coming year or two. Then if you do go out and flip, maybe you're still earning a really decent income off of flipping. Maybe it kind of died down last year, maybe the last half, but this year you start killing it again. Well, your income is significantly increased this year. We need to have a conversation because you need to understand what your liability is going to look like because your income has gone up. And I can do that by doing a tax projection for you. I can do it in a lot of cases. I do it with my clients in November and December, but we might have a need to have a conversation in one of the quarters during the year, the first, second, or third quarter. I'll do a tax projection and we might talk about adjusting your estimates so that you're timely paid. But then you might be one of those investors that say, you know, I don't want to pay any taxes until my tax return's filed, because the way I look at it is, I'm saying you, the taxpayer, if this is you, I'm just borrowing money from the IRS at a really low income interest rate, which is fine because I have clients like that. But I may have clients who want to pay quarterly estimates to pay in enough that they're not going to be faced with penalties and interest for not paying their taxes timely. So they just pay in enough, but they still might owe something, or they might get a refund back when I file their tax return. And I have clients that, you know, they want to pay to the penny. They want to be have a zero amount on their tax return. It never happens, but you do have clients like that, and it's perfectly fine. You just have to understand which client you're working with. But that goes along all just in this section of tax due dates. Getting into choosing a tax advisor.
One more thing on the tax due dates.
Go ahead. Yep.
And that stuff. Now, is quarterly estimates, payments, those are done for each individual tax return, right? Partnership, individual, C-Corp.
Maybe. Definitely for individuals, if all your income, most of your income or a significant income is earned independently, not through a W-2. So you're going to be doing estimate vouchers. But even through your partnerships and S-Corps, you might have to pay like a state quarterly estimate or a local quarterly estimate. You wouldn't necessarily have to for the IRS unless maybe you're a foreign partner. But definitely state and local, you potentially could have to, even though they're pass-throughs and you're not supposed to be taxed at those levels. Some states, actually most states, have a entity tax that they make you pay the tax at the entity level, because what they found through the years is, as a pass-through, if you weren't paying, you may have been a non-resident of that state and a tax return was filed, that non-resident may not have been filing in the non-resident state. So that state was losing revenue, losing tax money, because it was hard to track those down. So most states came up with their own law that they capture a tax at the entity level, and it's a non-resident tax that has to be paid.
Okay. So my version of the quarterly estimate voucher payment thing is, let's go back to when you had a job. Okay. Most of us did have a job or do have a job. You get your paycheck, and I guess it's all digital now, but we used to get paper paychecks. And on the bottom part, it would do a breakdown of how much you made for the year, how much was paid to federal, FICA, FUI, SUI, and all this other stuff. Okay. And so because you don't have W-2 income with withholding, and based on the previous year's tax return, they're set up, okay, we want you to pay quarterly to stay current, I guess, as far as the tax that you owe. And so if you pay too much in those quarterly payments, is just like withholding, you're going to get a refund at the end of the year. And if you didn't pay enough, then you're going to have to pay more.
Yep.
Is that fair?
Yeah.
Okay. And then I want to add on extra special session, if we can, in here. And you're going to love it. Go ahead. I'm going to surprise you with this one.
Can't wait. So the next topic I'm going to talk about is choosing a tax advisor. And here's what I got to say about that, because I am a tax advisor. Our industry is suffering. Our industry is suffering just like any other industry for staffing issues. So what I'm finding is, on the staffing side of it, we're looking for individuals to come work for us that can add one and one and get three. You know, it's that sounds bad, and I don't literally mean that, but even I know that the local colleges we have the University of Louisville and Bellarmine University, Bellarmine University here in Louisville, or even Spalding University, the students in the accounting section of those schools have significantly decreased to practically nothing. And our firm here in Louisville, we're the second largest firm in Kentuckiana, actually. And we struggle to find staff. Even the top firm that I used to work at, great firm, they are struggling to find staff. And, you know, generally you would think the bigger firms kind of are able to pick from the cream of the crop. There's no crop. Everybody is struggling to find individuals. So what's happening in a lot of accounting firms is, firms are looking at their list of clients, and the first thing they're doing is they're increasing their rates. And I've heard in some cases, some firms have increased their rates by 50% from last year. They're also looking at the bottom number of their clients, and they're sending them out letters. They're basically firing them. And it's not so much that they're firing them. You know, I guess there are sometimes clients, or you're in situations where you do fire a client. They're not firing them. They just can't handle them anymore. And it's not beneficial to the firm to work with that client any longer, because they're not making money and they're not servicing them well. So that's going on in public accounting firms all across the United States. So you take that, and here's the conversations I'm having when I meet with prospects, because the number one thing when I'm talking to a prospect is saying, hey, I'm leaving my current accountant. How much do you cost? And I understand it. Everybody is looking to try to find the most inexpensive product they can find that works for them. The problem with that is, in my mind, because I'm on the other side of this, because I'm going to be more expensive. I'm a bigger firm, so we're going to be a little more expensive than a smaller firm, even a one-man firm, potentially. But my bigger firm is going to have more resources, and we're hopefully going to have more knowledge in a lot of cases than some of the other firms. When I'm talking to that prospect, and they ask me how much I cost, what they're failing to ask, you know, maybe that should be a question. Everybody wants to know what you have to pay. I mean, that's a fair question. I'm not saying that's a wrong question. It's a fair question. It just shouldn't be the first question. What I would suggest if you're out looking for a tax advisor is, your first question is, what do you know about real estate? What do you know about investing? And there's things that you can test, and I don't know everything. I love real estate, and I'm always seeking to learn more about it, even on the real estate tax side. Not everybody knows about real estate tax, and not everybody knows 100% of it. So I'm always looking to learn more, but you can quiz the person you're sitting with. Don't just automatically accept that they know what they're doing. And it's a fear in me now that I realize this, because back in the day, thankfully I've been healthy throughout my life. But when you go to a doctor, you always assume they know everything. And you always assume, or at least I always assume, that whatever condition I had, they knew how to treat that. Or if you go to, you know, I'm a hefty fellow. I like to eat dinners and lunches and breakfasts. If you go to a restaurant, you assume they know how to make your food, right? You assume that they know that if something's bad, if something has gone bad, they're not going to serve it to you. Or you assume if you've asked for something in a certain style, like you want a medium sort of steak, for example, they're not going to send it out to you raw. You expect that or assume that they know what they're doing. Same in my industry. And there are generalists and there are specialists in any industry. A generalist knows a little bit about a lot of things. A specialist knows a lot about one thing. And that's what I tend to think I am. I'm a specialist. I don't want to deal with manufacturing returns, manufacturing clients, because I don't know much about manufacturing. There's other types of industries that I know I'm not good at. I know a little bit, but I don't know that I would service that client well enough. I know real estate investing and I know realtors, and that's who I like to deal with. So think about when you're meeting with an advisor, come up with some series of questions, just real estate questions. We came up with a series of things we were talking about, just depreciating short-term rental. Does your real estate account know that? Did you have a question, Mike?
No. In fact, what you're saying is a bullseye, and I just remembered this. Okay. I've got a special report. It's a 7 must-ask questions before you hire your real estate attorney and CPA. And if they get their free real estate consultation with you, we're going to fire that out to them right away.
Great. I think that's awesome because
it includes the answers too.
It's always good to have the answers. Those would have been nice to have in high school and college. So just always ask the questions first and feel comfortable with your advisor that they know what they're talking about. And then the next step would be, we're not even asking price yet. You want to feel comfortable with your advisor. I spoke with a great prospect, good guy, just a couple days ago, and that was his purpose. He was looking for a new advisor because his old advisor was significantly increasing his cost. And I went through a series of questions with him, and you know, I'm asking him questions too. So I asked him, I said, you know, well, do you like your advisor? And he said, well, yeah, I like him. And I said, well, does your advisor get back with you when you ask him questions? Well, yeah, he does. So I said, well, does he know what he's talking about? Does he know about real estate? And he said, well, you know, I feel comfortable that he knows enough about real estate. I said, well, don't talk to any other advisors. You know, I told him that it would be best to stick with his advisor. I don't want him moving. Like I told him, I want every investor I can get. I want them all, but I'm not going to get them all. But what I do want investors to know is I want you to find a good investor that you feel comfortable with. And if it's something, you know, I could have probably helped him, but I'm going to be just as expensive as his guy. I don't want him to move to me just because he's moving on price. And, you know, I'm going to tell a prospect whether or not it's a good idea for them to come to me. And I might even give them names of other people if it turns out that they want to, you know, work on price.
Let me give you a good example, a great CPA, okay, who I still have today. And he's in his sunset portion working part-time now. Okay. So
before you get into it, I'm going to agree with you right away. He is a great CPA.
Yes. Yes.
Good guy.
Okay. So anyway, back when I had my job as a policeman, I was shocked. Here's what I did. The arrangement I had working in the criminal ignorance unit, intelligence unit, doing long-term undercover stuff. I told our unit, there's like six guys in the unit, two bosses and a captain. I said, look, I don't want any overtime. You guys can have all the overtime. Okay. And you divvy it up among yourselves. I don't care. I don't want it because I want to spend my time in real estate. But I said, if something happens, you call me and I'll be the best assistant there ever was. And I work 40 hours, 30 hours straight, whatever it takes. So anyway, I do. They all sit around and they talk shop if you've been in a job environment. So here they are drinking their coffee, smoking their cigarettes and this and that. And they're talking about their tax returns and how much they're getting back and what they think they're going to get back, you know, blah, 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 blah. And so some of them 4,000, 6,000, some of them 3,000. Oh, this guy worked a ton of off-duty jobs. So he got spanked on Schedule C with his 1099s. He's got to pay 8,000. And so mine comes in and I'm getting a refund like $15,000. And they're looking at me like, man, you can't do that. You never work any overtime. How are you getting a refund of $15,000? And I said, well, I don't know, but he's got a CPA name down here in the bottom of returns. So here's a sign of a good tax advisor / CPA that you're talking about service. So file these tax returns. And I'm going to bet 2 or 3 weeks later, after the dust settles from the deadlines and you guys relax and get back to working, he calls me up and he says, hey, I need you to stop by my office to sign these tax returns. I said, hey, Mike, I was just over there. I signed them. So I'm thinking, oh, I'm going to have to pay some more or this and that and blah, 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 blah. He says, no, you might want to do this one. He says, I went back and amended your returns. You're getting another $17,000 back in refunds. Now, I didn't ask him to do that. I didn't even know anything about doing that. He did that on his own. Now, ask yourself, does your tax advisor / CPA do that? I bet Eric does.
Definitely.
So, definitely. I mean, that's awesome.
Yeah, it's always good. The things I've learned, it's tough in the public accounting through, like I said, this will be my 25th tax year. And for a lot of my early career, it was just preparing a tax return. It was putting a number on a return and just getting it in the right place. The way I look at it now, as I'm looking through a return, I want to do an analysis. I'm just not trying to get that number on a line. I'm trying to make sure that number makes sense. And I want to have a conversation. That's why I like to specialize in real estate, because I can have conversations that create more conversations that create potential planning. And that's how we advise. It's not just throwing a number on a return and sending it out. It's actually having communication and conversations, not just during tax season, but throughout the year for sure.
So for a standard of real estate investor taxpayer, here's what I recommend. Long about the first part of November. Okay. Preferably before Thanksgiving, schedule an appointment to meet with your CPA tax advisor. And here's what I want you to do. Print out your balance sheet with this year's numbers and last year's numbers so they can see previous and percent and stuff like that. And print two copies. Okay. Then print out your profit and loss year to date compared to last year's year to date and print out two copies of that. Now go in and have your meeting. They'll close the door, sit in their circle table. And your CPA will start looking at this stuff. And if they're an expert like Eric is, whoa, wait a minute. No, it looks like over here you sold this property, but you still own it. So you got to zero out that asset. Okay. So they're going to find things that you missed. That's why you hire them. And so I'll have my red pen or pencil and I'll jot down. Sometimes I have three things to fix. Sometimes I might have 35 things to fix. But now you go back and you fix that in your books, wrap up the year. And then you can send that to them. And that is planning in my part. And so they'll see things. Well, wait a minute. That looks out of line here. Move this over here and do this over there and blah, blah, blah. That's what you do. And that's what you're an expert at. So I love that.
Yes, definitely agree. The final topic I have in this part of the series is start to act like a business. And I've kind of been... I'm forming my ideas as I'm coming along. I change my mind sometimes on some things. So the first thing I want to talk about, and I'll tell you, I've looked at your system. I actually have clients that use your system, and it's fantastic. And here's what I got to say about accounting software in general. We won't get into products, but let's at least talk about accounting software, because I'll get questions I'll work with new clients, prospects. I'll see things on forums of, well, you know, if you just have a couple properties, just jot it down on a spreadsheet, jot it down on a piece of paper, and you're great. Give that to your tax person and everything's fine. And it is, it works. But here's where I'm kind of changing my opinion on keeping your data. And here's what I feel like is important. When I meet with clients, the first thing we, you know, not the first thing, but one of the things we jump into is tax planning. How can I save taxes? What's my tax liability? What can you tell me to help me save in taxes? And if it's a situation where they're keeping a spreadsheet or if they're just jotting down numbers, we're not even to tax planning yet. We're going to get the low dangling fruit off the tree here first. I'm going to talk to them about keeping their data. And why is this important? If you're just jotting down numbers, how do you know what your cash flow is like? If you're not tracking things, maybe you're doing it on a spreadsheet. And if that's good, great. Earlier in one of our series, we were talking about cash flow and net income and the differences. But if you take and look at your rent income for the year and you subtract out all your expenses, you've got a net income number. You're including your depreciation expense. But are you taking that next step and are you calculating your cash flow by adding back the interest and depreciation and subtracting out your mortgage payments? Because that's cash flow. Are you there? Because you're not done yet. The next thing, are you considering your capital expenditures, CapEx? In 10 years, you're going to be replacing a roof at $10,000. What you may not realize is it cost you $1,000 this year for that roof 10 years from now. So are you including that in your numbers? And that's where I've changed my opinion. I believe it would be great for you to use an accounting software. And if you use that accounting software, what you're going to find is you don't know anything about those numbers you're putting in. And I tell all my clients, you can get it in there. You can't break it. You could get it in the wrong place. I can put it in the good place for you. And then we could start having a better conversation during planning on what you need to be doing. Because with those numbers, I can point out maybe your rent income. Maybe you need to think about what your rent income is like. Can you raise your rents? You spent an awful lot on repairs last year. Are you have some sort of maintenance plan put in that maybe you're doing a drive-by or a walkthrough of your properties on a regular basis every year to change an air filter, a furnace filter? I highly recommend you consider getting more comfortable with numbers. You don't have to know it all, but you do want to fully understand, because what I want to be able to ask you is what your true cash flow number is. Because if you've gone out and purchased, let's just say 10 properties over the last 2 years, you did it, but are you using your money or are you using someone else's money? And I know Mike would love that, what I just said there, because all this is about passive investment. You want people working for you. You're going to hear that from all kinds of guru investors, and it's true. If you're going to do this, don't be putting your own money into it. You got to have maybe some startup money, but make everybody else work for you. And you don't know that if you're not keeping good accounting numbers in a software, at least have a decent spreadsheet put together. That's what I mean by acting like a business. If you're not doing that yet, it's January. Consider it and start doing it, because you're going to have better conversations with your tax advisor.
Remember my 3-year IRS audit? I had to give them my QuickBooks file.
How'd that go, your 3-year tax audit?
Got a green light.
Perfect.
No income tax, no penalties, no interest, no late fees, no nothing. I'm the only person that I know that has come out of a 3-year deep dive audit over a 12-month period, 10 to 12 meetings, and got a green light. Unbelievable. Okay. Using my system. Okay. My CPA. Okay. His jaw dropped. How many people do you know that survived an audit from the IRS and not have to pay any money, not have to write a check? I don't know of anybody. Everybody I know had to pay some. But anyway, here's what I was getting to. With my system, for example, you're talking about accounting software. I've got an apartment community that I bought probably 26 years ago. With a matter of clicking two buttons, I produced a report that shows the performance of that property for every year during the 26 years. The total number for each year. Okay. Boom. Simple. Powerful. In my system, your tax summary reports are already set up for you through the year 2050. So as you pay bills or make bank deposits, okay, and buy properties and borrow money and loan money, it does your reports for you behind the scenes that you can give to Eric. Pretty good stuff. But anyway, so I could not be where I'm at today without my InvestorBooks Pro system with tenant tracking. And I don't want to do a big commercial on that, but I'm telling you, it works. Eric's seen it. He's blessed it. And in fact, Josh Hardy, one of your clients, told me, he says, man, he said, Eric Shadowins wants to get with you. And see, that's how we got introduced. And and Josh says, man, he loved it, what he saw, what I took to him. That was unbelievable. But anyway, so much for the commercial. And then you need to know your cash flow and then how much money you're making and what your true cash flow is. If you get a generic accountant, bookkeeper, they're not going to do their books the way you and I want to see them. Okay. For example, you buy a house or you got a rental property and you spend $10,000 putting a new roof on it. Did you know that the trained accountants, the generic ones, the generic bookkeepers, they don't put that on a cash flow report. They take that immediately and put it into your asset. And then if you're sharp enough to remember, you're looking at your cash flow report, it looks like you're just slaying it. You're making all kinds of money, but you go, oh, wait a minute, look over here, house number 17. Wait a minute, last month I spent $10,000 on a new roof. Where's that at? Oh, no, that don't go on this report. It goes over here. Well, wait a minute, it came out of my bank account. I want to see it on my cash flow report. So there could be a huge disconnect if you're not on top and you don't know your numbers. Okay. And that's just one example. And figure this stuff out and now you can do that. So you need to know what your real true cash flow is. Okay. And try to have every property support itself. That's a good rule of thumb. There's one other thing. Remember I said, I'm going to surprise you with something?
Hit me with it.
Okay. And this one burns my butt. And this has to do with traditional IRAs and we're all of this self-directed. Okay. So self-directed, did I spell it right? IRAs. Okay. And this blew me away. Self-directed IRAs. We have the traditional and we have the Roth. The traditional is tax deferred. The Roth is tax free. Here's what blows my mind, Eric. I didn't realize this or know this, but I would assume that every CPA / tax advisor would recommend to investors to get a self-directed Roth IRA because it's tax-free profit and income for life. Yeah, it's got to be seasoned 5 years, 59 and a half, you can start getting distributions. Okay. But what I discovered was many CPAs are recommending to investors to get a traditional IRA because you get a tax benefit today. Now, Carl Fisher, my good friend who owns a CAMA plan, and I've got accounts at Equity Trust. I got them at CAMA plan. Carl Fisher's a genius on his stuff. But anyway, he said it's like paying taxes. Let's say you're a farmer. Would you want to go in and buy your seeds and pay income tax on or pay taxes on it now and then go grow your crops? And when you harvest them, it's tax free. Or would you rather not pay taxes on your seeds, go grow your crops, and then when you harvest them, pay income tax on all of it? Fair analogy?
Yep.
Okay.
I'd agree with
so
that.
Why do CPAs encourage folks to get a traditional IRA instead of a Roth IRA?
Well, you know, I can't say for certain, but here's some thoughts I could do have on that. Today you're making, and I'm all about Roths. You might talk to another advisor and they might be all about traditional, but to me, just like you're saying, I'm making all my money potentially, well, if I make all my money in the going forward, my income is going to grow as I go forward. So if today I'm paying the tax, I would have a better chance of taking it out tax-free. I have less worry and I'm not paying the tax then. But you also could look at it. There's a potential that if you are getting the reduction today, when you're making potentially your most money, when you take it out, when you retire, maybe you're taking it out at a lesser amount. So the tax.
No, might be don't, like, you don't want to plan to be poor.
No, I'm all about the Roth IRA. And I highly recommend if it were me, that's what I'm doing. But what we want to make sure that our listeners are aware of, you're doing rollovers to start this, right? So you might be leaving a W-2 job and you have a Roth 401k, or maybe you just had a Roth IRA out there dangling around that you've been contributing through your lifetime. But now all of a sudden you're interested in real estate investing. Another creative financing in order for you to purchase a property is purchase it through a self-directed IRA. Now I'm going to throw up red flags right now. Just so you hear this, I always like to throw up my arms and say, this is a red flag moment when before you ever get into it, Self-directed IRAs are extremely complicated, and there's what's called prohibited transactions that if you don't know them well enough, you could get in trouble with the IRS to the point where whatever amount you have in there from your IRA, they might deem it as a distribution if you have a prohibited transaction and you're taxed immediately. So we'll kind of go there. What I want to say is investigate and understand them before you do them, but definitely something you want to do potentially if you're looking for creative financing. And then if you have this account that you want to do a rollover, you could roll over your Roth 401k from work into a Roth self-directed IRA. And the difference is, if you just roll it over into something like a Vanguard or Fidelity, not throwing names out because there's other financial advisors out there. If you roll it over in that, they have kind of a menu of items you're going to choose from.
Self-directed.
Self-directed. But if you do something like Mike's saying, through Cayman Plan or through Equity Trust, you're going to choose what you want to invest in. And through a self-directed IRA, you can invest in most anything. You can invest in real estate. You can invest in cryptocurrency. You can invest in gold coins. You can't invest in collectibles, but you can invest in something like gold coins. And let me throw out an example, a recent court case of why this is important. There was a couple who went out and purchased a bunch of gold coins through their IRA.
I remember this one.
They took their gold coins and they put them in a safe in the closet of their personal residence. When they filed their tax return, they threw out a big red flag because they failed to report a certain amount of income. They got audited. And as part of the audit, the agent inquired about their self-directed IRA. And as part of the conversation, the couple let the agent know, yes, you know, we bought these gold coins. They're in a safe. They're here in our personal residence. Everything's great. We're saving. It's perfect. We're by the book. Everything's super. And what they didn't realize was, and what the agent did to them, the agent made a huge adjustment on their tax return and forced the amount of their IRA, the taxable amount when distributed, they made it a taxable distribution, even though the couple just had these gold coins in a safe in their home. And why did this happen? The couple committed a prohibited transaction. And I can't tell you, that's probably the best one I can tell you. There's other prohibited transactions. There's a ton of them. But what happens is an IRA needs to stay independent of you. You can't touch your IRA. And what they did was they were holding their coins. They put their coins in a safe. And even though they weren't spending it, they had access to their IRA. And it's IRAs are set up, retirement accounts are not meant for you to touch until you retire and you take the distributions. So hopefully, you know, I'm blowing a lot of hot air here probably, but if nothing else from Mike and I's conversation about self-directed IRAs, understand you want to educate yourself on them before you do them, because somebody else might make an argument that, well, you know, self-directed IRAs are bad because you don't get to take advantage of 1031 exchanges and the losses, and there's other things that you would on the outside. That's partly true, but every situation is a unique situation. And the example I gave you, if you can't get into investing for no other reason, but you have a large pot of money that you can roll over into a self-directed IRA, that is something to consider.
Here's another thing, okay? With the Roth IRA, remember, you've already paid income tax on the dollars that you're going to contribute when you open or do your annual contribution to your self-directed Roth IRA. Well, since you've already paid income tax on it, it's like the ultimate savings account. So remember when you were growing up as a kid, yeah, your parents said, well, you get a checking account, you get checks and money flies around, all this and that, but you need to open a savings account. And it was more cumbersome to get that money out. You had to go to the bank, fill out a withdrawal slip, take it to the teller, and then get your money.
I don't even know how to do that anymore. How do you even get money out of it? I go through the drive-thru and they laugh at me every time because I have to press for assistance because I can't figure out how to get money out of my bank account other than ATM or even deposit. I can't even deposit, but go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. So anyway, remember, you've already paid income tax on this. So you can withdraw at any time if you get any kind of financial crunch or whatever it is. You can withdraw your contributions penalty-free. There's no harm, no foul, no nothing. And because it's your pension, it's protected from lawsuits with one exception, okay? And that is If your IRA owns that rental property, then the owner's getting sued. Your Roth IRA would be there, but you can have more than one. So that is awesome. It's powerful. And then you can take the money that's in a traditional IRA and get with your tax advisor. And if you got your depreciation cooking right, you can contribute X number of dollars over into your Roth IRA and not have to pay any income tax on it. Now, that's advanced investor strategies there. But I'm telling you, oh, and I've got a home, me and Carl, we created a home study course. Okay. It's called Tax-Free Profit and Income for Life. And you can go to mikebutler.com. You can get that. It holds your hand and it shows you how you can open a Roth IRA, get it funded, make your offer on real estate. And we interview Rod Owens, who he was 54 years old. He knew he should have a Roth IRA and he didn't. And he went to Harry Borders and he says, I got a seller finance deal with 29 rental properties that I need help on. And Harry said, do you need the income now? He said, no. He says, go see Mike Butler. So we crafted, long story short, we put all 29 of these properties into his self-directed Roth IRA with the seller financing being paid off in 7 years. He's got that. Now he's got his 5-year seasoning. He's over 59 and a half now. And that thing's cranking out over $25,000 a month he can put in his pocket tax-free. And at 54 years old, he didn't even have an IRA. So get the tax-free profit and income for life. And you can pass this on to your kids. There's new tax laws on that. They're limiting that in some way, some form. But the bottom line is, it's still a great, would you rather have tax-free profit and income for life or try to figure out how to keep reducing your income tax? I like that. So anyway, this one went over. We covered a subject that I surprised Eric with. So let's do this. Eric, because you've been on this 6-part series, he's got a bonus just for you, a free real estate investor consultation. We covered a whole lot of things in a 6-part series, and I recommend you go back and listen to them again because you'll pick up more stuff from Eric on this. But go to LinkedIn and punch in Eric Shadowins, and you'll get his LinkedIn thing to get your free investor consultation with Eric. You can email him at eshadowins@dmlo.com, or you can call him at 502-326-2319. And he's not about beating up your CPA or anything like that. You heard him just describe that, but this is awesome. I'm excited we could have him on here and get you current, up-to-date tax law information for today's real estate investor. So if you're getting started, go listen to episodes 1-10 about getting started in our 5-hour real estate week podcast. That'll do you a lot of good to give you a big picture. And then the other thing, I need your help, and Eric wants your help too. So please click the follow, subscribe button, share button, give us 5-star reviews, both on Eric's website and LinkedIn page and mikebutler.com and the 5hourrealestateweek.com. We need all the help we can get on that. We want to reach out and help as many investors as we can. And sign up for the free investor training webinars. I do them every Tuesday at noon. It's called Power Lunches, mikebutler.com. With that, I'm going to wrap it up. And I want to thank you for doing this extended episode here, Eric. And I want you to give your final words of wisdom to our real estate investors listening now.
I work with small investors. I work with large investors. I have investors that have 100 properties, and I have some that didn't have any properties at the end of 2021. Now they got 9 and 10. You always hear it, and it might sound cliche, but wherever you're at in investing, give it a shot and stick with it and build your team of advisors. Have your mentors out there. Have your team of advisors that you can lean on when you have questions. And make sure it's a, like I said, a CPA, an attorney, a lender, have all that put together, a coach, a realtor, everybody put together, and that will make your business function that much better. And that's what I have to say about it. I love real estate investing, and good luck to you, because it's something that, you know, I love myself. So keep up the good work and keep churning on it, and you'll do a good job with it.
Thank you, Eric. You're wonderful. You're genius. I love learning from you, buddy. You're awesome. So with that, guys, we're going to wrap up this 6-part series, and we'll see you on the next one. Adios.
Glad you joined us for another episode of 5-Hour Real Estate Week. The best thing you can do now is put this information to action. To help you get started, Mike created a free resource for you called How to Buy 50 Houses a Year, Even with Your Job. Download it now by going to mikebutler.com/50houses. And we'll see you on the next episode.